This week, I'm sort of exploring the problems confronting English teachers and confronting us all as we handle the English language. And today, specifically, I'd like to talk about the difficulty that arises from some of the historical accidents that have happened to the language that create some of the difficulties. It's not only difficult for us to learn English, it's especially difficult for somebody who does not speak English to come over here and learn English, because English presents all sorts of problems. And that's what I want to talk about today by taking a Cook's tour. You took a Cook's tour yesterday through contemporary theology, and I'd like to take today a Cook's tour through the English language. I don't know whether you can all see the board or not, but at the top I have spelled a word. Some of you may have seen that word before. Do you know what the word spells? G-H-O-T-I?
Fish.
Fish. Why?
The G-H from enough.
The F from enough, right.
The
O is the I sound in women. And the T-I is the S-H sound in nation. All right, now, that spells fish. It's F-I-S-H, right? Enough, F. Okay, to indicate how silly English spelling is, and that's sort of my symbol today, I guess, for some of the difficulties and problems that confront us in the English language, and why there are so many exceptions, literally more exceptions than there are rules. Let me begin at the beginning and take you back to the very beginnings of what eventually became the English language, by going back, and you can see the squiggly line around there. That's my map of Europe. It's not a monster. That's Italy, vaguely recognizable. Greece down here. England and Scandinavian countries are up in the top there, and so forth. Somewhere, we're not really sure which, where, because we have no real idea of where this took place, but somewhere, either in the western part of Russia or in the eastern part of Europe, there was a prehistoric tribe of people whom we have identified as the Indo-European family, a cluster of tribes. We have no evidence that they existed, no artifacts, no written record, but we know that there once was such a tribe, because all of, or most of, the contemporary European languages, including English, and its Indo-European, including Sanskrit, were once one language. It has split off. Imagine that tribe, and I'll show you the kind of detective work by which we can tell that we were all once one people. Imagine that life was good there, and the tribe throve, and or thrived, depending on whether you're an English teacher or not. And imagine that. As would happen, small groups began to move away from the parent cluster. And in doing so, they crossed barriers, mountains, lakes, rivers, which made it difficult to keep contact with the parent tribe. Imagine yourself, some of you have had that experience of moving from Nebraska, let's say, to San Francisco, or to Key West. After, let's say, even 10 years, what kind of changes do you think would take place? Let's say this little offshoot has moved now beyond the barrier, they have broken off. After 10 years, how would their language change? Any suggestions? How would their language have changed? Why would the accent have changed?
Climate
could be responsible. How would climate affect? Well, it might. If it's warm over there and it's cold over there, they would suddenly have to have a new word, right? Suddenly, I'm cold.
Lifestyle
would change. Yeah. Sure, if this is a hunting community and they move into the sea and suddenly fish are there and ocean, you need new words for a new lifestyle. Any other reasons that you can see why things would change?
Would this, because of smaller numbers, or just leaving the bigger group having to do it?
Leaving the bigger group with it.
I mean, less people speaking it? Or?
There would be fewer people speaking it. Probably the English teachers would be left behind, and therefore you would start using IANC and things like that, because nobody is there to watch you and keep guard over you.
Get their own ways of saying things together.
Sure. How does that happen? Why do you get your own way of saying things?
Well, I don't know how it starts. I can see how it continues once it started. But maybe just circumstances. Somebody would come up with it.
Okay, it's not a lifestyle, but probably people being sloppy. Mm-hmm.
It's an independent invention. I'm just starting to say.
Sure, and it's an independent invention. Each group, every teenager develops his own slang, partly as a way of separating himself from his parent culture. And that would happen here, too. They would develop their own ways of saying things. You can see the result of that in our country in the dialectical differences, some of which are very extensive. If you go down to Appalachia, for instance, and walk into a coffee shop, literally, you will find it very difficult, if not impossible, to understand. And apparently, isn't there somewhere in Washington a small community that has developed its own language that for everything, from coffee to cinnamon rolls, to everything, that makes it virtually impossible for an outsider to come in the community and make any sense out of what they're saying at all. But at any rate, change would take place. Even after 10 years, even after a year, there would be lots of change. As new experiences, new things, oceans and so forth, that's why we know pretty much where the Indo-Europeans were. There is no common word in all of our languages for ocean. And therefore, we know that the original tribe must not have had a word for ocean. There is a common word for beech tree, if you trace the roots back. And so we know that it must have been where the prehistoric beech forests were. But there is no common word for tiger. At any rate, all sorts of changes would take place for sloppy reasons, for new lifestyles, for just trying to be different, for forgetting. Back here, if you hunted for pheasants, and there are no pheasants over here, pheasants would tend to disappear from the word pheasant would tend to disappear from the language, or take on a new meaning. You might start calling something new pheasant. So old words then also will take on themselves new meanings. I was back at St. Olaf for our 25th class reunion, and this May, and as we stood up to sing the college song, which brings tears to the eyes of all bullies, we noticed with a great deal of laughter that they changed a line in that song. They no longer say where students are gay amid their work and
play.
We sang it that way. We sang it that way. But there again, the word, you see, there is a word which in our generation has taken on a new meaning, so much so that the old meanings can't really be used very much anymore.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I know that another way that language changes is in relation to the other people that they run into. Were these people going into unpopular areas, or were they?
No, that's another thing that would happen is you meet new tribes and pretty soon you start developing new languages in much the same way that we did when we came to America. Keokuk, Iowa, for instance, wouldn't have been Keokuk, Iowa if we hadn't come across Keokuk, the Indian chief, and all sorts of Indian names. Maize and so forth. All of that is due. So a great part of our American language has in it Indian terms. So that happens.
So the same thing happened in Indo-European.
Sure, the same thing happened to these people. So it's a combination of these things. Now, how do we know, since Latin and Greek and French and German and Swedish and English really don't sound very much alike at all anymore, how do we know that all of these, including Sanskrit, were once part of the same family? What would tend to change not at all, do you think? What word after 100 years might be almost the same?
Water.
Or like
water.
Like water, yeah.
Water is everywhere. Water is necessary.
Water is everywhere. You probably use the word every day.
Fire.
Fire. Words that are for elemental, common, everyday things, particularly the words, I suppose, that are personal to us, father and mother and brother, would probably not change at all. And that is indeed what is the case. If you take the English word mother, for instance, and you find it in German, its pronunciation is slightly different, but it's certainly recognizable as mother. If you take, and in Latin, mater, it's the same. That word has really not changed much at all. That indicates that all these languages must have once been the same. Even words that appear to be slightly different, father, for instance, is still father, even though it's spelled with a B in German. But in Latin, it's pater, P. Now, what happened was that the groups, a linguist by the name of Grimm, who you probably remember as a collector of fairy tales, discovered that that the groups of tribes split as they moved towards Central Europe, and some initial consonants changed, so that initial P's changed to F sounds in some of the tribes. It didn't change in Latin, so Latin still says pater, but all the Northern European languages have the F sound for father. Brother hasn't really changed very much at all, except again, Grimm discovered that the B sound changed to an F sound in the groups that went down and formed Latin. So that brother, reader, frater in Latin, fraternity.
Is there any time that you've been set that for?
this is all really in prehistory. Way back. We don't know when this took place or how it took place, because by the time we begin to get records of these people, ancient Greece, for instance, so it goes way back, thousands of years. But if you go over to Sanskrit, for instance, let me just give you one example of, this is Indo-European after all, Sanskrit, the word for brother is B-H-R-A-T-H-A-R, brother. So even that, those common, everyday, loving words haven't changed very much at all.
Is there a common word for higher power?
I don't know. I'm very dangerous when you're the limits of my knowledge in. And so you're in danger of not getting the questions answered. No, I don't know what the word from God is in these. But at any rate, then, now let's come up to history and to about 200 or 300 AD. And if you know your history, remember that Rome, as it began to spread out just before its demise, went through Gaul and conquered England, conquered the Celts, Christianized the Celts eventually when Christianity came to Rome. But as Rome's power began to weaken, 300-350, the Celts began to sense that they might have the capacity, the Celts, or Celts, however you pronounce it, began to see that they might have the capacity to drive the Romans out. So, under the great Celtic hero, King Arthur, they invited, who may be a mythical person, but may have been a real person, they invited several Germanic tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, over to England to help drive the weakening power of Rome out. The Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, very much smaller tribes, the Jutes, did come over, and before 400 drove the last remnants of Rome out. Unfortunately, the Angles and Saxons, being very, very powerful tribes, decided to stay, pushed the Celts back into a very small corner of England. Today, the Welsh language is one of the holdovers from that ancient Celtic language. Who the Celts were, we don't know. They were not members of the Indo-European family of languages. There is some tantalizing evidence that they may be one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, because all the way down from the Mediterranean area across Europe, there are Hebrew place names that can be traced back to Hebrew origins, suggesting that maybe way long ago, in biblical times, this group came by and eventually settled in Celt, in England. But very little of our language is Celtic. Very little of our habit culture is Celtic. We have King Arthur as the hero. We have mistletoe and Halloween. We have druids. Stonehenge isn't even probably Celtic. It comes from some other source. But the Celts, then, are the holdover is the Welsh language. And what happened then in 400 AD is that Anglo-Saxon England and the English language, the Anglo-Saxon language, became dominant. Anglo-Saxon is a Germanic language, and I'll read you an example of it shortly. This is from about 600 or 700 AD. It is the part of the Bible translated into English. This is the first record we have of the English language. I'm going to read a parable from the New Testament. see if you can, and if you have German, or if you're familiar with German, you probably will be aware of what I'm reading from. But you'll notice, too, that the very basic words, and if you can pick those out, you'll understand what the parable is. But here is pure English, the only and last pure English that we have. This is Anglo-Saxon. On he rasta on konta his fader, on tha yet he was fair his fader he hinna yasea, on with mid milkir and sestirin, on in hin arn, on hin biclipta, on kisti hinna. Tha queth his sumu, fader, ich singoda on heoven and before him pay, nay ich ne him worthy that ich the sumu bail you name it. Tha queth se fader to his theolum.
Prodigal son.
Father. On he arrayed, and he arose then and came to his father. On he arasta, and came to his father. Notice that even the word kiss has not changed. That's original English, Anglo-Saxon. It's a Germanic language. It has case endings. It's inflected. It does all the things that German did. And if you can understand German, you probably have very little trouble understanding Anglo-Saxon. Why, then, don't we speak this language today? Why are we sitting here talking what we call English? By a series of accidents, and that's really what I want to talk about today. The first of these accidents took place in 1066, when what happened?
William the Conqueror.
Okay, William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings defeated Harold. William the Conqueror represented the Normans, who lived on the north coast of France in the area known as Normandy today. Originally, however, and it's important to know this, they were Scandinavian. And so William the Conqueror conquered England not as a foreigner, but as somebody coming home to claim his own. They felt from the very beginning that they were the genuine Anglo-Saxons, even though they lived in Normandy and adopted the French language and French customs. So then in 1066, then, we were taken over, the English Isles were taken over by French-speaking people with French culture and French customs. Obviously, they could not adopt the Anglo-Saxon language. They had no desire to. The French court, where they had been familiar, was far more complicated, and the Anglo-Saxon language was very simple. And so, for 200 years, French became the official language of the courts, of the schools, of the legal profession, and Anglo-Saxon was spoken then for those 200 years only by peasants out in the sticks growing the crops. The bilingual culture tended to be the merchants, the middlemen in the towns who bought from the peasants and sold to the nobility. But during those 200 years then, Anglo-Saxon was not spoken very much at all. Now, shortly before the time of Chaucer, shortly in the 13th century, the French began to become enamored of Normandy, and so they gave the Normans, who were living in England and ruling Normandy from England, an ultimatum. They said, move back to Normandy and don't be an absentee landlord, or we're going to take Normandy away from you. The Normans refused, and the French took Normandy away from the Normans. Partly, and now I'm trying to explain why we don't speak French. We very well could have, except by another accident. What happened was that in a fit of patriotism, the Normans, who regarded themselves as Scandinavian, as Vikings, the old remnants of Viking raiders, said, okay, France has taken away Normandy from us. We are not going to do anything French. We are not going to speak French. And almost overnight then, English came back into being as the accepted language, the official language. But if you're familiar with Chaucer at all, you're aware that by that time, 200 years later, lots of things had happened, and there was no possibility of going back to the English language. The Anglo-Saxons, for instance, really had a very simple legal system. There were earls and churls, servants and rulers. But the Normans by now had kings and queens and princes and counts and dukes and duchesses and juries and so forth. There was no possibility of going back to the English language. Besides which, without the benefit of English teachers, the peasants had really degenerated the English, quote unquote, but they certainly had changed the English language.
Besides which, if you've ever taken a foreign language and tried to pronounce it and tried to make sense out of it, you realize what a botched up job you do. And that's what happened to the French, who now decided they were going to speak English. One example of what happened is that all the old Anglo-Saxon words and I'll just put three on. All the old Anglo-Saxon words were inflected. This word, Anglo-Saxon stanas, was either stanas, stana, stanum, depending upon where it occurred in the sentence, in much the same way that the German noun does today. But obviously, in any word which has more than one syllable, like this, which has an inflected ending, part of the word is more important than the other part. This part carries the meaning. This part just says where it is in the sentence. We can do without this part. And so, under the mispronunciations by the French and under the sloppy use by the peasants who didn't care where it occurred in the sentence as long as you understood it, this word, by the time it gets to Chaucer, has become just a final grunt, stanna. This is what gives Chaucer his beautiful lilting prose. One that aprillo with his shortest something, the drought of March hath pierced to the rota, and so forth. Chaucer pronounced those final E's, but only as a dying gasp, right? The E carries really no meaning at all. And so today, we have this same word without the final E, stone. Same thing with this, sunu, sunum. Became sonna, became son, without the final E, S-U-N. Beiran, beira, bear. Okay, sometimes we drop the final E, sometimes we didn't. That's one of the things that gives us, that's how we can end up with G-H-O-T-I to spell fish. Why do we spell through, T-H-R-O-U-G-H? Because that's how it was pronounced in Anglo-Saxon, through. We degenerated to say through. Why haven't we gone all the way and say T-H-R-U? I still mark that wrong, although it's a much more sensible spelling. Why do we say N-I-G-H-T instead of N-I-T-E? Because the Anglo-Saxon said nicht. A nicht there was. Through, and so forth. So that's what's happened. Stone, the final E is still there in the spelling, but it's not there in the pronunciation, and it creates endless difficulties for any of us trying to learn spelling, particularly from somebody who comes, let's say, from speaking German, where every word is pronounced, every letter is pronounced the same way. There are no ifs, ands, or buts. There are no exceptions to the rule. Here, there are exceptions everywhere, because our pronunciation has changed. Furthermore, and that is in itself, I think, is an incredible difficulty in the English language. Why doesn't the written word tend to change as fast as the spoken word? Partly because it's written down, and that's the way it was done before, and that's the way it's done now. And that creates big differences in the way we speak and in the way we write, and makes writing, I think, for us much more difficult than speaking. But another important change, and I want to be sure to get that in, another important change that took place that has had even a greater effect on the way in which we speak and write, is the fact that the Anglo-Saxon language and the French language, side by side, stayed in our speaking, partly because the French had a lot of words for which there were no Anglo-Saxon words that you could go back to, and also simply because it's hard to get rid of a word once you've gotten used to using it. And so, in a sense, problem number two with English is that we literally have two languages in one. There are almost two ways, you could say, of saying anything in the English language. One, a way that goes back to the French imports, and the other, a way that goes back to the original Anglo-Saxon English. We have something like, 330,000 different words in the English language. Of those words, 900 and only 900 are English, Anglo-Saxon. The rest are all imports from Norway. Any word that ends with a or has a K sound, SK sound in it, is Scandinavian. Ski and sky and so forth. The word egg is Norwegian. The Anglo-Saxon word for egg is eye. to I, to either. But obviously the Norwegian word won out, and today we say A. So all of these are imports. What I've done is put on the board, if you can now see it in my clutter, some equivalents to show you an example of the two kinds of languages that we have. The Anglo-Saxon word hut was once identical to the French word cottage. But today, as you can see, hut is something lower, cottage is something a little bit more fine and elevated. Nobody buys a hut by the shore, you buy cottages by the shore. The Anglo-Saxon word begin and the French word commence. No school has beginment, right? We have commencement because it's somehow a little bit more uppity. Help and aid. When you're drowning, anybody shout aid, aid? You shout help, help. Because somehow these Anglo-Saxon words, in spite of the onslaught of foreign words which have come into our language, still retain a kind of warm spot in our hearts. Folk is a warmer concept than people. To be a people is not as is colder and emptier than to be a folk. To be somebody's darling is, again, warmer, isn't it, than to be somebody's favorite. And friendship, because it's something you can see, it's an adjective you can see, a friendship versus amity, the French word, which is an abstract word. All right, now, here's the problem, then. If one wants to be educated or civilized, which of these languages should you use? And for a long time, the school system suggested that one ought to learn, that the purpose of going to school is to learn to use the uppity, elitist language. And that generally meant the bigger words. Occasionally, I still run into students who have had courses in a college called vocabulary building. And you have to drum that out of them once they get to college. And what they've learned to do is say begin instead of commence, or dwell instead of live. You know, nobody dwells in a place anymore, they live of places. And so a big fight has taken place then between the Anglo-Saxon words and the French words. How should an educated person speak? Do you show off your education, show that you're not one of the crowd, by using the big words that you learned to use? Flowery, ornate, prose. Or should you use, as Mark Twain suggested, just say it like it really is. Tell it like it is. Use the simplest, plainest, most direct word possible. 50 years ago, the school system proudly taught you to say this. Today, almost any English class you walk into will suggest that these are the words to use. And I'd like to give you some examples, in fact, of how poets have used these sets of words. George Orwell, we tend to think of the English Bible as flowery and ornate, beautiful, particularly the King James Version, as a very elevated language. It is an elevated language, but it is not flowery. It is, in fact, some graduate student must have counted this somewhere, 92.5% Anglo-Saxon basic one-syllable words. And part of the power of the Bible, of the language of the Bible, comes from the fact that it is not flowery and elevated, but simple and plain and direct. George Orwell took a passage from the Bible and translated it into the what most of us are suckers for, this elevated language. And most of us are. If it uses big words, it must have big concepts. But here is Orwell. Listen to the beauty of the, and listen to how many of these words are one syllable, because the English language, remember, lost many of its syllables, and it is heavily a one syllable language. This is from Ecclesiastes. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Now Orwell says, here it is in modern English. Objective consideration of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account. Many of my students come to college thinking that that is the way to really write. That really is profound. And actually, as Orwell suggests, it's empty, it's meaningless, it's just gobbledygook. Because somebody is trying to be impressive. Somebody is trying to use this second set of words. I don't have to go to Orwell. Orwell begins with some actual examples of contemporary prose. All of you, if you've ever picked up a textbook, will discover this same kind of prose that tries to be elevated and elitist. Here is an essay from an essay on psychology. On the one side, we have the free personality. By definition, it is not neurotic, for it has neither conflict nor dream. Its desires, such as they are transparent, for they are just what institutional approval keeps in the forefront of consciousness. This is all one sentence. Another institutional pattern would alter their number and intensity. There is little in them that is natural, irreducible, or culturally dangerous. But on the other side, the social bond itself is nothing but mutual reflection of these self-secure integrities. Recall the definition of love. Is not this the very picture of a small academic? Where is there a place in this hall of mirrors for either personality or fraternity? It's full of nice big words, which we are common to thinking are big concepts, but as Orwell points out, really aren't. So Orwell then is on the side of hut and folk and help, the simple, plain, everyday words. And so is the King James Version of the Bible. On the other side is where most of us think we ought to write. But I would agree with Orwell, that's not where I think good, direct, plain, simple prose is. So the school system has undergone a tremendous shift then in what we have emphasized. I still get students, as I said, who are taught that good, flowery, big words are where it's at. You ought to go through and learn college vocabulary. But the first thing I have students do is throw the thesaurus away, because all it does is add to this kind of novelty. Say it as plainly and as simply as possible. That doesn't mean that it has to sound like first grade. It certainly doesn't. The King James Version of the Bible doesn't sound first grade. Most of you are familiar with Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem, How Do I Love Thee? The first 37 words of that poem, which everybody, I think, would agree is elevated and beautiful, are one-syllable words. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways I love thee, with depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. All one-syllable words, plain, direct English. Not elevated, not flowery and ornate, but moving and profound. John Donne, the 17th century English religious poet, whose relationship with God was not potter and clay, but somebody who needed to be beaten and hammered and forged in a like somebody making a metal vessel, gains a kind of power too in his poetry from being plain and simple and direct. Here is just the start of a Donne poem in which he's talking about the fact that he needs a God who will hammer him and mold him into shape. Batter my heart, three-person God, for you as yet but not breathe, shine, and seek to mend. That I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. There are only three or four words of more than one syllable in there. So again then, depending upon when you've been taught and whom you've been taught, we really have two completely different ways of saying things in the English language. You can say you're wordy, or you can say, I'm intoxicated by the exuberance of your verbosity. Now, which is more communicative, which is more impressive? Or that's the way the spheroid ricochets instead of that's the way the ball bounces. Or up the proverbial estuary without proper means of propulsion instead of up the creek without a paddle. But today, most teaching suggests, let's get back to the roots, let's get back to these basic words. If you took a tape recorder and taped the average conversation of any of us in a given day, you would also discover that about 90% of the language we use when we're not trying to be on stage and show off, 90% of those words are these basic Anglo-Saxon words that have survived all of these things. But somehow, when we want to impress, we elevate, we start using the big words, and that, Orwell points out, I think, is a real mistake. But it's a liability of the English language. Okay, now, another difficulty of the language is that in the 18th century, when the age of science began to dominate our thinking and rationalism as a philosophy began to dominate our thinking, suddenly people who were worried about the language began to be concerned because the English language had no grammar. It had no spelling books. Shakespeare in a single play can spell the same word in three or four different ways. And quite often the typesetter who ran out of type of one letter would simply substitute another letter. So there were practical reasons for it too. But there wasn't any grammar. There wasn't any correct way of speaking. Everybody simply wrote sort of the way he'd been trained or the way he felt like writing. And in the 18th century then, in this demand to be reasonable and rational, suddenly we decided we had better have a grammar. Now, if you don't have one of your own, what do? You take a grammar that seems to be from the best and most elevated language in the world, which, of course, is Latin, a great language of the great culture. And so what we did in the 18th century is to take Latin grammar and impose it on the English language, and it never fit. We don't have seven or eight cases in the English language. We don't have pronouns that do what they do in Latin. To a slight extent it fits, but by and large, there are more exceptions to our grammar than there are rules. And the reason for that is that it isn't our grammar in the first place, and it never really fit the English language. And that is why it is awfully difficult, if not impossible, to teach grammar to.
Couldn't they have had one? I mean, like, I've learned that, like, if you're studying some language, like, I know somebody that studied the Finnish American language, and she discovered that, you know, it had its own grammar. So there would have been one there if they discovered it, but then there would have been
sure, because what a grammar does is simply describe the way a language operates.
But
there would have been one there.
There was one, but they didn't know how to.
But see, Latin has always been regarded as somehow better than.
Your diplomas from most of the colleges you graduated from are in Latin sometimes, right?
Has anybody ever gone back and, you know.
We do now, sure. If you're familiar with the grammar that your kids are getting in many of the school systems now, transformational grammar and the structural linguistics and so forth, there's an attempt to undo that. Your kids come home probably with different terms than you used. And with different names for things than the old Latin grammar names. And the reason for that is we're trying now to adjust our grammar to suit the English language, rather than trying to make a straitjacket to fit the English language into grammar. You can't end a sentence with a preposition. Why not? I mean, it's, you know, everybody always has. And now the rules are, as Winston Churchill says, that's a situation up with which I will not put, to indicate how ridiculous it is to have that rule. Or some of you have been taught that you cannot, absolutely cannot begin a sentence with but, wrong, or and. Why not? I mean, it always has been done in English. Also in the 18th century, if some of you were here last night, we began to get scientific, and we discovered that in math, right, two negatives make a positive, and so in English, that has to be the case too, and so the double negative, which Chaucer and Shakespeare used, went out the window. And now you can't say, I haven't got no bananas. But not because it's ununderstandable, not because it really means positively you have bananas, but simply for an absolutely silly reason that we were trying to be scientific and it never really worked. So that, then, is a real problem with the English language. And the final problem that those of us who are parents or who have been children to parents or who have been teachers of English have is that this process of change, which I've been describing this hour, is still going on constantly. And the question becomes for me as an English teacher, where do I hold the line? Should I continue to correct, it is I, it is me, when everybody says it's me? Our texts now say, our college texts say, it's me is correct and it is I is wrong. Everybody uses it. How can you possibly say it is I? It is I is stuffy, it's stilted. Anybody who uses it, you say, oh, a snob, or an English teacher.
How about
or
when you change the sentence around and say, me is it?
Well, me and me, that's still awkward. So in that case, I is right. But doesn't, what I guess we're assuming now is that usage really determines the thing. Let me give you an example of a word. Your grandchildren, at least, probably, you still say, most of you, mice, right? Two mice. Your grandchildren probably will say mouses. Because you don't say heis for house. The language is becoming more and more standardized. And one of the things that's happening to the language that your children speak is that it's probably becoming more reasonable and natural and so forth. Let me give you an example of a word that is right in the middle of making the shift from a weak verb to the standard ending. The hang, the past tense of hang is what?
It used to be hung.
Okay. Now, when you use, they are both correct, but in different circumstances. When do you use?
To kill.
You hung up
hang.
Clothes.
The man was hanged, the clothes were hung. Mm-hmm. Is correct today. In 20 years, probably, everybody and everything will be hanged, right?
What's the rule?
Which was
it? What do you mean the rule?
Well, the clothes were hung and the man was hanged. Why? What's the rule?
Because I don't know.
Don't
just
sin.
There isn't any rule. The problem is
because he's a person and the clothes are in that.
I don't know why one got to be hung and the other got to be hanged.
Maybe because hanging people is archaic.
But hanged is coming in. Mouses is coming in. The standard ending gears is coming in. You now see that occasionally.
What about either or either?
Either or either, that went out long ago. In fact, I couldn't tell you when to use either or either, or shall or will. Those
are
things,
going out too, shall and will are going out.
They're all going out.
How about who and whom?
That is about out.
Oh, really?
Is whom stuffy?
What do you teach then? That's the beauty of it, that's a teaching.
Do your students at Augustana say me and my friend?
Yeah, but so do most of the faculty. But now, at what point, you see, at what point is something right or wrong? At what point do I put a red mark on the paper and say, my own reasoning is, I suppose, when a student writes ain't or uses a double negative, there's a need for those, and I understand it perfectly, but still socially it's not. If you say, I haven't got no bananas, people are going to understand you, but they're also going to look down on you a little.
Sure. It looks like one thing you're talking about is perpetuating the difference between the spoken language and the written language. I mean, it's becoming a difference. In other words, we're emotional about some of these changes because that's the way we learn how to write, but we don't necessarily.
We all think what is right is.
We talk that way maybe too. Now the next generation, we say, okay, they're supposed to write that way. But you don't necessarily have to talk that way, and so the next generation maybe they can write and talk that way.
Some words
catch up, or is there always going to be a difference?
I think there's always going to be a generation. Part of the generation gap between you and your children is really a language gap. They are using literally a different language, sometimes deliberately, because it's a way for them to isolate themselves from you and form their own community, which they ought to do, which is healthy.
You say the language is always changing, isn't it? Gradually. English language. Like you look at colonial writings or maybe even revolutionary, you'll see a lot of words had E's on them where we've now since dropped them. I can't think of any.
Chicago Tribune made a vain effort to try to push THRU through for years, and 2 years ago, was it, they dropped. They said, we give up. We absolutely.
But I mean
the
silent E on the end.
Yeah.
I don't know if the one word could be feast, maybe that wasn't what.
Catalog
had an E on the end.
See, the English still hold color, C-O-L-O-U-R. We have O-R. Let me give you an example. Sometimes a word can completely change its meaning. This business of language is an alive thing. And as teachers, we're always sort of behind a little bit because of the forefront. What does the word gossip mean? What is a gossip?
Somebody talks.
Somebody who carries tales?
Not somebody,
who
a woman who, right?
Oh.
Who carries tales, talks over the fence, and so it's a person, I guess. Men occasionally gossip too. But if you look at the roots for gossip, you will see that they come from two words, God and sibling, and that was originally godmother. So that a gossip then in Anglo-Saxon England, then in Chaucer's time, was one of those friendly ladies in the neighborhood who bakes cookies Saturday morning and all the kids come in and have milk and cookies and so forth. But it's completely reversed its meaning and become negative. Nice. Nice has gone through some very interesting things. Nice in Anglo-Saxon was a prostitute. Suddenly, by the time I got to be in high school, it was nice to be nice. Now, nice is just a little too nice, right? Nobody wants to be nice. It's got a little sicky and syrupy. So it's on the way to alter again.
Nothing stays the same in this fluid kind of river of language.
Is there somebody who is kind of deciding these changes in our language?
I gotta talk about these E's being dropped.
That's a real problem. Who ought to decide? Let me give you an example and then come back and ask what you think we ought to do. Two cultures have tried to make sense out of this, the French, who have a French Academy, and the Norwegians. Mm-hmm. The French, a couple hundred years ago, and the Norwegians, only about 75 years ago, decided that this has got to stop. This word is going to mean this, and it's actually going to mean this from now on, and period. Okay? And this is the way this is going to be correct, and it's going to be correct from now on. My in-laws, who visited Norway about 5 years ago, growing up speaking Norwegian, but 50-year-old Norwegian, were in for the shock of their lives when they went back to Norway. They could read everything because the written language has to obey the rules of the Norwegian Academy, but the spoken language they could barely understand because that has changed right out from under it. And so the situation today in Norway is that there are two languages, a written literary language and a spoken language, which are going further apart. Same thing is true in French. You take French in college, right, and you learn French, and you're going to go over there and you discover what you learned is literary French, and the spoken language is radically different. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work to try to stem something that's alive. Latin has the fortune of being dead, and that's always going to be the same thing. But now let me get back to you. If we're going to decide when to drop the E's, who ought to do it?
Yeah, when do we do it?
I mean, who do you think, yeah?
I want to know, do the European countries adopt the changes too that are taking place in the American language?
The French are really horrified by the Americanisms that are creeping into the French. Every once in a while, the French Academy has a big long lecture on, you know, we've got to keep these pizzas, got to go, which became more American than, you know, or chow mein, which is not Chinese. It was invented in San Francisco, and now it's reached China. But yeah, in a sense, if you look at this as a kind of pollution, the power of America is really polluting all of them. The language,
okay.
But I don't know that you have to look on it as a pollution. It's just a thing which takes place. Okay, if you can't stop it, should then, as an English teacher, I just let it happen? See, there are some really sticky questions there about who ought to make these choices and who ought to make these decisions. When a student comes to me writing in a way that's quite different from mine, for one thing, it's intriguing to have all these varieties. All these dialects and so forth. But it makes communication difficult too.
King James is the old Anglo-Saxon, word syllable, easy to understand. Why all the new translations?
That's a whole different, if I were from Minnesota, I would say a whole nother instead of and whole other. Minnesota people do say a whole nother, right? Because it's difficult to say and whole other. Illinois people are more precise. They didn't even say it. But that's a Minnesota. That's a whole nother thing.
That's one of the to me, every English teacher even comes from different regions and different feelings. And one English teacher might feel one way and another English teacher another. And a child moves from California back to Minnesota and he learned one thing from one teacher and goes to another. And so I don't see how it could ever... Mm-hmm. You know, be just one way because it's gone too far and.
Well, it's been going too far for thousands
right.
of years. It's just.
And as far as saying one person is right and another is wrong, that's how it can never ever be.
Then should I put no red marks on the paper?
No.
Okay, but on what should I'm really concerned about on what to base that policy. It still just grinds me to no end to hear people say different than.
Mm-hmm.
But every different than,
yeah.
It should be different from, right? Because you can't be different than. You can be greater than or less than, but you can't be different than. You have to be different from. So it doesn't make no sense. But everybody, 90% of the people, say different than today.
Yeah.
Did you say that?
How about them?
Yes.
Were them, all them kids. My kids go to high school and I learned English in the proper way. And then they talk sloppy like this and I say it is not.
Why is that sloppy?
It is sloppy.
Well, you're saying kids is the wrong thing because that's referring to billy goats. You should say children.
Yes, but she's talking about grammar. She's talking about grammar. Why isn't grammar important anymore?
Well, I'm saying it is important, but if we were trying to be purists, then we ought to go way back to Anglo-Saxon. So I think grammar is tremendously important. But I don't know, I mean, are you saying I should continue to red mark? I still do. I still check it because it's just one of those things that bugs me to no end. Mm-hmm. But I don't have a reason for it anymore, different from.
How about two markers, green and red? Basically red, but basically right and green is the way you want it.
There's another concept here, too, which maybe is just the right session to fit into, maybe the one that I missed last week. But, and that was, I was just reading something in, the Gift of Child newsletter, and it referred to about teaching children language. And the people there felt that, you know, if you're going to really teach them to write, the way to do it is for them to write. That just learning these rules that you're talking about, let's see, they're in grammar school. And so what the English doesn't consist of is learning these rules. They're archaic, they're not going, anyway, they don't really help them in terms of how to express themselves in writing. So what the teacher should be doing in their, you know, writing instruction is to help them in terms of ideas, expressing themselves better and more attention to content,
okay,
rather than just analyzing the grammar. So maybe that's
what's happened to most English teaching, is that we've gotten away from the problem because we don't know how to handle the problem of grammar. So we let them slip by.
Well, yeah, but I think that maybe there you have in some instances you could let them slip by and in some instances not.
Well, a green marker might be a good idea.
Yeah, and you could say, well, it depends on who you're.
But now suppose, let me ask you, suppose that eventually 60% of the people, 60% of the time, start saying all them instead of those. At what point does them then become correct grammar and those wrong?
It's just wrong.
But if they're usage is going to change it.
Probably. Grammar.
But if let's say 99% of all of us started using all them, would it still be wrong? Yeah.
Well, does it change into an adjective then? Does them change to an adjective? And do we start listing that in the column with all the adjectives? Or do we leave it in the noun category? I mean, when do the books start changing to accommodate all that?
The college books change first. As I said, the high school, the text that we're using now for freshman English says it's me is correct, and it is I is mostly wrong. No, now let me were you here last night? Let me give you the example that I used last night and that the college text uses. Mm-hmm. Suppose a guy's gonna call up a girl for a date, which occasionally happens at college, but not as much as the girls want it to happen. And the guy calls up and says, "Hi, Sue." Suppose he says, "Is Sue there?" Or, "Is this Sue?" And she says, "It is I." What's he going to do, right? He's going to say, "I should call about the assignment." Because what Sue is communicating is a kind of stuffiness and formality. Now, on the other hand, if Sue said in that particular situation, "Hi, it's me," that's a warm invitation to further communication. Now, in that situation, then, isn't "Hi, it's me" correct? And isn't "it is I" wrong?
No.
Whoa.
I don't think it's wrong necessarily. "It is me" may be preferable.
Yeah.
But I don't see why we have to say "it is I" is wrong.
Well, I guess that's what our text says. But text, I suppose the first of all, the people change and start saying, you know, gossip is somebody who talks over a back fence. Then next, the graduate schools pick up the change. Then it filters down to the colleges, and then to the high schools, and eventually the elementary grades. My son, who just finished his ninth grade here, still is being taught that BSI is correct.
Well, they could be taught two concepts, couldn't they? I mean, you know, that it is, either one is basically correct, but it is me is more common.
Well, one is applicable in some instances, in that case.
Yeah, it's just that it's me is becoming more and more applicable.
It's more acceptable, it's becoming acceptable. And
it indicates a kind of informality that it is I.
We're throwing out the old concept of the subjective complement, basically.
Yeah. I can remember being in school where there was a grade. It was always going to be grade. So, well, they used to do this, they kind of don't do it anymore. But
yeah.
Right. But it's now, they're still saying that, but it's just different things. I mean, there's 20 years down the road of change.
What about dived and dove?
Okay. How many of you say past tense of dive is dove? It's dive?
It's dive.
Yes.
No, actually, dove is correct.
No.
What?
I was taught the dove is incorrect.
Uh-huh.
It's incorrect?
Incorrect.
I've never heard of dove.
dove into the water?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. See, what's happening is that all of the weak verbs are gradually shifting to the standard ED ending.
Mm-hmm. So dive will become lion.
Lion, that's another thing. That just sends me lion lake. But everybody was
there.
90% of our faculty couldn't tell you the difference between lion and lake.
Right. Oh, that, ooh. Uh-huh.
You know, there's another thing.
But it's just because I was trained 20 years ago, it just gets to me.
Yeah,
and
me
I
too.
Correct it, but it's a lost cause.
Well, the rule seems to be what bugs the professor.
What?
The rule seems to be what bugs the professor.
You know, we want to go back.
Well, not as precise as
like the words.
Well, in line and play, what's one?
Either play? Either. Mm-hmm. Either is the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
some
British,
places it isn't.
That's a British pronunciation.
Right? I lay out on
it.
We have something in our own family that's almost a reverse situation, and I'd like to share it. My husband, with the people he's working with, he tended to pick up, you know, what we would consider the wrong tenses. I have went, and so on and so forth. And it's bugging our 18-year-old daughter to the point where she can hardly stand to listen to him, and she corrects him all the time. So there you have a reverse situation.
Yeah, my son is that way. I think he speaks a far more precise, less informal English than I do in ninth grade. But I think that's just a part of the personality difference. But he is learning the rules, and because he just happens to have gotten a teacher who taught the rules.
Uh-huh.
Well, our written English then become like that too, so that, you know, we read books and we got...
Yeah, if you look back 300 years, you see an English that we can still understand, but it's a little foreign to us, and I suppose in another 300 years, they will look back at the language and consider it and say, how funny.
It's probably not going to change that dramatically in our lifetime.
No. No.
Yeah,
it takes a while. The real question that you're raising is, where should an English teacher be in this, conservative or liberal?
Yeah.
And I think that's a question a lot of English teachers are having a lot of trouble with today. Should I still correct lion? You know, the obvious goofs, I have no trouble correcting. I had a girl last year who talked about a roommate calling a prostitute on the floor. that I hope was wrong. But lion lay and who and whom and so forth, those are really gray areas that are very difficult. My mother was an English teacher. She had no hesitation in absolutely saying this is correct and this is incorrect. And so forth. But I do not have the same kind of sense of comfort, I think, that she has, that there is a kind of correct way of doing it anymore.
Did you ever hear of the word dastened? My mother used to say dastened all the time instead of
she. Dastened?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
I don't know where that...
You
do. Well, I know what you...
I think that's an idiom that arises from.
That's maybe somebody started saying it and then somebody else picked it up and they, you know.
Yeah.
How was it you? How did you dastened?
Well, when she didn't want you to do something, she'd say you dastened do that.
Oh.
And then you should do.
And dare not.
Maybe it's a combination of dare not and don't.
Yeah. Or the word
just I never heard anyone else
do
that.
Yeah.
I was talking about it back in Colonial days. Remember, German had an F-looking like letter that was pronounced like an S.
Mm-hmm.
And it got into the English language, because I went back to the Anglo-Saxon. Huh?
Because you see these writings, they still have it. Now it's, you won't see it anymore.
Right.
But in colonial days and even revolution. Yeah.
But I think even most German printing has dropped that today, haven't they?
They have now too, huh?
I think so. They've gone to the standard. Many of the things I've seen have gone to the standard, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the yes, I mean, rather than...
Well, did our language drop it just 100 years ago or so?
Well, I think longer ago than that.
Right after the revolution.
Yeah, I think probably after the revolution.
To get back to me and I, don't a lot of European languages have a familiar pronoun and a formal pronoun that was very important?
Is that going to change?
And in a sense, I suppose we do too. We have I and me. And what's happening, I think, is that our whole culture is becoming more informal.
Well, I and me is a grammatical difference. Whereas I thought in the European language, it was not a grammatical
difference. Yeah, it is. That's right. But we don't have...
You don't say it to a stranger, but you would say it to your...
Right. We don't have that in English, so I think we tend to use the two levels of English that we have to indicate that kind of informality versus formality.
That's why we use you all in the South, because you don't, you know, right. You really need a plural you.
Right.
You know?
You mean more than one, you all.
Yeah. Well, another reason for language change, we tend to think of Eastern pronunciation as somehow the elite pronunciation. But the fact is that probably Chicago English is more like the English that Alexander Pope spoke in the 18th century than today's BBC announcer, which we think is precise and pure English. It's the BBC pronunciation that's changed much more than Chicago pronunciation has changed. So if you went back and listened to Alexander Pope, he probably would sound, well, not quite a linear daily, but he would sound amazingly like Chicago English. Same thing is true with Eastern pronunciation. You hear of the Kennedys particularly say lore and order. With that R in there. That R is simply there because it's a sloppy way of saying law and order. It's hard to say. It's hard to make your mouth say law and order. Put the R in there, just like living with law and order. So that's a degeneration in a way. Degeneration of the correct pronunciation is not elitist.
I expect all them kids will never become. Right. But you just because it's identified with the lower socioeconomic, you know, class or... Right.
Yeah. Well, this opens up another can of worms about the use of idioms. Now, does that come from geographical sections or something that's part of our regular usage over a period of years? Yes, slang is constantly, as somebody said, slang is constantly coming into our language and lasting for a little bit of time. A few slang words make it and become accepted part of the idiom.
By the skin of our teeth, for example.
Yeah, but that's a good example. I'm going to talk Friday a little bit more about the way in which we hold over these cliches. Most of us have no sense of what it means to hang by the skin of our teeth, where that even comes from. We use it without having any knowledge of what it means, or ride roughshod over it, or strike while iron is hot.